So, good evening. I'd just like to sit quietly, actually. Anyway, I haven't taught or attended a retreat for quite a while, about 6 or 7 years, so it'll be interesting for me to see what happens. So, good meditation is built on generosity and morality. We live a generous life and an ethically impeccable life, then there's a foundation for liberation and for happiness. And when I come into this hall, I'm so reminded of all the generosity that has poured into this hall. So when you look at this
construction here, it's Ajahn Kusala.
And then when you look at the aura around the Buddha, that's Frank Blom. And when I look at this, that's Ajahn Karuniko, and then Anagarika Supong. Lao people came here and still continue to come every Sunday since 1985. Every Sunday, you know, so there's a lot of goodness in here. There's a lot of goodness that has come to make this possible. And you've all been a part of that. So we're very fortunate. We're very fortunate to be here, to have the capacity to contemplate Dhamma, to have this beautiful space. So gratitude is a very good way to start, always. We cut off at the end of the retreat. Most people feel grateful, some don't. So everyone's kind of gushing gratitude, and it, you know, it's kind of like Oscars, people making their gratitude statements and so on. But actually, perhaps it's also good to start with gratitude, because if you think about it, when you get enlightened, you're probably very grateful, right? So why not just start with gratitude? Why wait? And gratitude is a kind of condition of consciousness that doesn't ask for anything. Whereas tanha, craving, is always asking for something. So the more one can open the heart to those kinds of attitudes, the easier it is to watch the breath, to cultivate wholesome states of mind. So personally, I feel very grateful to Ajahn Tiradhammo and the Sangha here for letting us come, because we're really stretching their resources, aren't we? I heard 7 or 8 people are in tents, so hats off to you for being roughing it. So that, you know, the sense of gratitude and what's come into this place helps bring a kind of reverence to our practice. You know, if this was just a club bent retreat center and you were paying, you know, $700 a night, you know, if your mushrooms weren't cooked just right, you'd be angry. And so that kind of a space is usually a very demanding space. I want something. I have my rights or whatever. Whereas this kind of space is more something that a community has created, that we've all created, and all of you have been a part of this, and we're participating in that. So reverence. When I think of this, I think of all the my peers who have been a part of this life of mine. I think of my teachers, Ajahn Sumedho, Ajahn Chah. And then if you just take it logically back, I think of the Buddha, Venerable Sariputta, Venerable Mahamoggallana, Venerable Ananda, Venerable Upali, all these great beings who practiced with the Buddha. And that all comes to us. And all the lay people who were involved in that. So we're a part of something bigger than just our own neuroses. You know, sometimes meditation can be this kind of self-development thing, you know, always working on yourself, which at my age it gets pretty boring, right? So, but when you take a more kind of grand view of this, the beings have been doing this, have been involved in this, and I think when you come into the shrine and you see that Buddha image, use that. You can use that. I do use it as a contemplation. Well, there is enlightenment. There was a being who attained enlightenment There was a being who had the gift of teaching and had the compassion to teach. And there are beings who have been doing this and passed it down to us. So then coming into a shrine room like this and doing this chanting can be a very beautiful way to enter into meditation. It has a lovely ritual quality to it. It brings out a sense of community, opens the heart. Rather than just kind of plunking down in your cushion for 20 minutes, you know, that kind of get it done, which is very utilitarian, but sometimes that lacks the beauty and heart of devotion. Anyway, the Theravada teaching is for reflection. It's not a dogma. And reflection is a skill which, if you don't understand it, I don't think you'll ever figure out Buddhism. Because you cannot figure out Buddhism through thought. Thought will always take you to doubt. But if you use the language of Buddhism and the ideas of Buddhism as a reflection to look at your own consciousness and see what that means for you, then you internalize the teaching becomes yours, you own it, and then it has a very good effect, very good result, hopefully. So whatever I say during this retreat is for reflection. And one of the things Ajahn Chah used to say to us when listening to Dharma talks was to listen with your heart rather than your head. And you know, sometimes, like nowadays, there's so many Dharma teachers. You know, you have these, you get on the internet and you can get your choice of Dharma teacher in any religious discipline, in any Buddhist tradition. So sometimes you can get into a kind of comparative mode. This one has better jokes than that one. This one's analysis is more clear. So you get a kind of popularity contest going around Dharma teachers. Or if you have an overly developed intellect, you can be listening in a very critical way. You can be comparing all the time, comparing, well, I don't know. That's listening with the head. Well, listening with the heart is more like letting it just come into you and say, just seeing how it affects you. So even if you're bored, you know, it's like it's late in the evening, you've been meditating all day, and the monk just goes on and on and on. If you're listening with your heart, you say, oh, boredom feels this way. If you're listening with your head, oh, he's so boring. You know, why doesn't he stop talking, blah, blah, blah. Or you feel inspired. Oh, that was really great. Now, this is what inspiration feels like. And this is the reflective capacity we have as human beings. We can reflect on how things affect us. And from that reflection, then we take that teaching in a way which is not just intellectual, it's insightful. This is what Vipassana really is about. It's an insightful process. And I'll talk about that. So reflection, listen with your heart, it's ideas. I use the rituals of Theravada Buddhism and the structures of Theravada Buddhism. So a shrine room is a place which is sacred, if you will. You could say everything is sacred in that way. But there is something special about a shrine room, so obviously we don't wear shoes. And one of the things that I've been trained as a monk is whenever I go into a shrine, if there is a shrine in the room, say in my kuti or here, first thing I do is I bow. And that's a part of the ritual of Theravada Buddhism. You come in, you compose the mind, you collect the mind, you look at the Buddha, and in the looking, what you're trying to do is awaken the mind. So when you're looking, you stop the mind. Just stop and look and be. And try to bring your mind to no thought. Because so often our lives, we're sort of rushing from thing to thing. And so when you come into the shrine, use the Buddha Rupa as a way of remembering. What that Buddha Rupa represents is the awakened mind. So you look at it and awake. So you're really present. And then sit down from that sense of presence. So it's very, very useful. It's very, very, but it's also very beautiful. So it also can bring up a sense of devotion. So we use the chanting, we use the rituals as a part of being mindful. It's part of our mindfulness practice. There are other ways to do it. You don't have to bow. You won't. You'll still get your lunch if you don't bow. Won't punish you. And so bowing can feel very, you know, if you're not used to it, you feel very awkward. Well, then that's what you look at. Right? So if you've never bowed before and everyone's bowing, and, I don't know. So that's your reflection. Oh, this is what it feels like to feel awkward. Or maybe feel critical. Oh, bunch of superstitious Buddhists, you know. Okay, then that's what you reflect on. This is what critical mind is. Or then maybe if you've never bowed, you kind of risk it when no one's here. Right? And you go for three quick ones or something. Whatever. So the form, you know, the form that we function within is a kind of vehicle for reflection. There's nothing right or wrong about it. It's a vehicle. And that's what we're trying to wake up to how life affects us and try to figure out what is it about human consciousness which is very liberating and what is it that causes suffering, quite simply. So in terms of, say, like this idea of a vehicle, when we were in Thailand, Ajahn Sumedho would kind of give these talks about Theravada being, well, it's not a Rolls Royce, but it's good enough. It's just a Volkswagen, but it's good enough. And that was really quite good, because you can always look at your tradition and say, me, you think, oh, the chanting should be different, or we should do things differently, but it's something you surrender into. So the idea now is you surrender into this form. We have a schedule. Now your mind may say, oh, I could make a better schedule. Yeah, sure. But it's good enough. So that's the schedule, and that's what we try to live by. What is it? I think 5:30 in the morning we start, and it's pretty easy for a monastery. 6 o'clock, etc., etc., and we go through. And then we have a meal time, breakfast, and lunch, and some tea, and so on and so forth. So what the beauty of this structure is that it's something you can give up to. You don't have to organize it. You don't have to organize it, which is great. So you don't have you could always leave if you wanted, you know, in prison, but you don't have the freedom to kind of reorganize the structure. You have the freedom to watch your mind in the structure. And that's the idea of training. That's the idea of precepts. That's the idea of our vinaya, of our rules, our protocols. It's an opportunity to give up to something and then watch consciousness within that, how you react, how you like or dislike or whatever. So there's the freedom to observe. And then within that observation, you watch where the resistance is, where the liking, disliking is, and so on. So in that vein, then, Venerable Tita Vija, I think, gave you some of the housekeeping information, right? And there's all of that. And then the other large piece of this is the routine, so that routine is posted. And there's a range of ages here. I think the eldest is about 81 and the youngest is mid-20s. So there's a kind of range of energy. So try to do as much of the retreat as you can. But if it's blowing your knees out or you're just exhausted, then rest, right? Use the structure as a way of reflection, you know, on how it affects you. So obviously a person who's 81 needs more rest than a person that's 25. So effort is kind of, effort has to be with wisdom and compassion, but also determination. You don't want to just take the easy way out every time. So it's something you learn about. There's the schedule, and then there's what's called the eight precepts, and the refuge is in precepts. So maybe we could just look at the format of that, because what we do is we have a ritual where we do that quite formally. So if you could go to page 59 in your hymnals. So the traditional format is that someone asks for the three refuges and eight precepts. So that's the top of 59. And then the chanting goes that I would chant if you go to taking the three refuges, We start by chanting homage to the Buddha. So I would chant Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa three times, and then you follow that. So what that means is there's several ways to look at this word Buddha. And when I can just kind of share with you how I use the language, but when I pay homage to the Buddha in that sense, I think of that there is a being who realized transcendence, enlightenment, nibbana, whatever you want. So for me, it's a statement of faith and a statement of optimism that there is enlightenment, that there is transcendence, that there is liberation from the cycle of birth and death, that there is the deathless, the uncreated, the unoriginated, the unformed, the island, the refuge, nibbana, that there is that. And that's a kind of article of faith in Buddhism, right? And so when I pay homage, for me it's a very optimistic thing. When I bow to the Buddha, it's a very positive, devotional, optimistic thing that there is something really profoundly possible, good in human consciousness. Profound, not just a psychological rearrangement to make us more comfortable. Right? It's something very, very profound. And that's, you know, so the Buddha represents that for me. I don't know how it is for you, but that's how I use it. And that optimism is important in my own practice because sometimes the stuff we face in practice is not fun. Let's face it, you know, you just run into the most negative mind state sometimes or whatever. And that sense of uplift that a Buddha image can give to you or the reflection on the Buddha can be very, very helpful. That there is a path, that there is enlightenment, there is a path, and that path can be followed. And we can realize for ourselves. So when I chant that, or when I bow, this is one of the contemplations that I use. And if we go to page 60, then we have the three refuges. Buddhang saranang gacchami, Dhammang saranang gacchami, Sanghang saranang gacchami. I go to the Buddha, I go for refuge. So for myself, when I use this reflection, Buddha as refuge, then I use more the root of the word awake. So the root of the word awake indicates something in consciousness. When I'm present, when I know what's going on, when I'm not lost in thought or whatever, and I'm really present to the way things are, that's the awake mind. And that is a refuge that you can trust. Buddha as historical person, well, that's a kind of reference and devotional object, say, but as a kind of existential contemplative possibility, the awake mind is a refuge because the awake mind knows how things are. Now that doesn't require any kind of a belief. You don't have to believe in the Buddha. You don't have to be a card-carrying Buddhist. It's something which is very human and very natural. So taking refuge in the awake mind. So as I said, when you bow, consider that. Take refuge and be awake. Be present. Stop the mind. Stop the thinking. Stop the constant self, whatever's going on. Come to no thought. The Dharma we use in a twofold way as well. Dharma is the teaching. So we have the various ways that the Buddha described our conscious experience and the way out of suffering. But that Dharma is pointing to something which is beyond words, right? And when there's a realization of Dharma, then it's something which is beyond words. It's our own. So when I'm, let's say, if I'm getting irritated at someone, yeah, and my mind's still, oh, why don't they stop doing that? They're so foolish. And then I awaken and I notice, ah, irritation feels this way. Then I'm taking refuge in Buddha, that's the awakened mind, and Dharma is, ah, knowing, oh, this is suffering, or this will change. Knowing of Dharma. If I just think irritating thoughts, then I take refuge in irritation, which is not a good refuge. I take refuge in anger, I take refuge in fear, not a good refuge. But as soon as I awaken to that, oh, fear feels this way, anger feels this way, then I know Dharma. This is the Dharma of anger, or this is the Dharma of fear. And that's something I can do. It can sound a bit abstract, but that's what we're doing in meditation. We're awakening to Dharma. The Dharma of fear feels this way, just this way. And then Sangha is used in a kind of twofold way. As an assembly, it usually refers to the ordained Sangha. So those beings who have made a commitment, so for our life, a commitment to celibacy, a commitment to a certain level of renunciation, a commitment to practice the teaching, to study the teaching, and so on. And sometimes it's referred to as the Arya Sangha, that assembly of beings who have realized some levels of enlightenment. And so that's at a kind of social level. But at an inner level, Sangha, for me, again, these are personal. This is the way I've been taught, and it's not dogma, right? But Sangha as what is Sangha really? It's the beings who do the practice. So it is the practice. The practice of what? The practice of morality. The practice of generosity. The practice of being responsible in the world in whatever way I am responsible. The practice of meditation. So it's the doing. It's the activity of being a spiritual being. And so taking refuge in Sangha for me means like the rules I live by. That I have a commitment to these rules. That's what taking refuge in Sangha is. For lay people would be having a commitment to five precepts, say. That commitment is refuge. Sometimes people will have said to me, oh, you're attached to being a monk. I said, I'm not attached, I'm committed. There's a difference. I heard of a monk who was being very clever, and he was at some dinner or something, and there was wine. He said, I'm not attached. And he drinks some wine. Well, that's a very cool thing to do, right? But it's stupid. It's like, you know, like let's say if you're a father and you're married to someone, and if, as a father, well, I'm not attached to my wife, and have an adulterous relationship, right? I'm not attached. Commitment. Commitment is different than attachment. I'm committed to the precepts. Why? Because the Buddha said, keep the precepts, or practice generosity, yeah? As a monk. Keep the precepts. And then that commitment comes from a sense of faith and so on, but then it becomes a beautiful way to live one's life and a protection to oneself and one's society. So like commitment to some set of ethical principles, as one of the teachers once, Ajahn Jayasoro once said, I think, that the precepts aren't there to make you comfortable. You know, if you want comfort, then don't read about the precepts. They're there to protect you, there to protect your family, and so on and so forth. And this is what we mean by refuge in Sangha. It's a commitment. So now, in modern terminology, Sangha is used very loosely. So like, I don't know here in New Zealand, but I know in Canada, any slight interest in meditation makes you a member of the Sangha. And I ask people, yeah, but what's your commitment? You know, are you just sort of watching your breath every 6 weeks? You know, or are you giving something up? Is there relinquishment? Is there renunciation? And that aspect sometimes, I think, in Western Buddhism gets a bit lost. That you need to take this word and not invest any meaning into it, you know, kind of, it just becomes a non-word, right? So in the traditional sense, Sangha is a real deep commitment to the practice and to a way of life. And that refuge in Sangha then becomes very significant because it carries you through all kinds of things. It's very helpful. So that's the three refuges. And so the way it's done, Buddhang Sarang Gacchami, Dhammang Sarang Gacchami, Sanghang Sarang Gacchami, and then Dutiyampi is the second time. And then tatyampi means a third time. So we do that line by line for those who haven't done it. Then I would say, in, right at the bottom of page 60, tisaranagamananiti tang, and you would reply, ama bonte. Then if we go over to page 61, these are the precepts which, in again, most of you know the eight precepts, but just in case there's someone new to this, there are several sort of ethical structures which we contemplate in Theravada Buddhism. One is the five precepts, and that's the usual, the kind of ethical structure which is recommended for lay people. And the eight precepts is the ethical structure which we use in a monastery. And that structure is both ethical and renunciant. Some of the protocols here are about moral precepts, and some are just renunciant precepts. So that's important to remember. I spoke about this, I think, on Sunday. I found, because I live near the borders of Quebec, which has a very strong Catholic influence. And one of the difficulties I find with people who have a Catholic background is they look at precepts in a kind of through a lens of good and evil. And Buddhism isn't like that. It's not so much good and evil. It's skillful and unskillful. So when you follow skillful intentions, you get skillful results. When you follow unskillful intentions, you get unskillful results. And so it's not a matter of good and evil, it's a matter of skill. Kusala. Ajahn Kusala, Kusala, skillful. I was just mentioning in the Dana, we had a Dana with some Sri Lankan friends, one of the ways we talk about the law of karma. Plant an action. It's an agricultural simile. Plant an action, reap a habit. Plant a habit, reap a character. Plant a character, reap a destiny. Yeah? Plant an action. So, I'm meditating, and someone is restless next to me. And I'm just about getting calm, and they fidget. Right? And I get irritated. Irritation comes up. And I think, why don't they leave? Don't they know I'm meditating? That's an action. It's an action of thought. And that action means the next time I sit beside them, plant an action, reap a habit. Next time I sit beside them, I'm going to be anticipating their movement. I'm sure you've been through this. Then as they move, and I say, why don't they stop moving? Plant an action, reap a habit. Third time I sit beside them, more uptight. Fourth time, more uptight. Plant a habit, reap a character. I become a grump. I think, I can't meditate here. It's too noisy. And I leave. Plant a character, reap a destiny. And I go off on my own. And I live a lonely life. I mean, that's an exaggeration. But that's, you know, that's what we're talking about. Like moment by moment, we're making intentions. And so this structure is about that. It's about the way we make intentions. Whereas an idea of good and evil, if I go back, I didn't digress too much there, back to good and evil, like, you, good and evil is kind of based on fear. I shouldn't do this. So guilt, fear, those things come from that kind of perspective on morality. But as a training, as a way of being a better person, that's not so much a good and evil. There are results. There are consequences. But it's a matter of doing the best I can. So it doesn't come from fear. You know, I'm afraid to break the precepts. It's not like guilt. It's more like, no, this is skillful. This is a good thing to do. So maybe we could look at those precepts. So the first precept, I'm not sure how conversant in Pali you are, so I'll do it word by word in Pali, and then we'll do the English. But I undertake the precept to refrain from destroying living creatures, so nonviolence. So it's quite often the precepts are talked about, they're positive, which is compassion and kindness, and the negative is refraining from doing. So what you might want, you might find a spider in your bed or something like that. So basically, don't kill it. Right? It's easy enough. So it's pretty easy here. In Canada, it's more difficult. We have a lot of mosquitoes. And boy, I get some murderous impulses. I'm still working on that. Adinadana, I undertake the precept to refrain from taking that which is not given. So in terms of the monastery, say, the kitchen is not available. Food is put out for us. We receive the food. But if you're hungry and you'd like some noodle soup at 11 in the morning, you can't have it, right? So the kitchen is not yours to take. Huh? And so what happens if you want to have noodle soup? You watch hunger. You will survive, right? If all the peanut butter's gone by the time you reach the breakfast line and it's not, you don't have peanut butter, may I suggest, don't ask. You will survive. Huh? Sometimes we become such foodies, right? That we think that like the religious life depends on brown rice or, you know, whatever trip we're into. But the renunciant life is, this is something that's given and it's good enough until tomorrow, right? And then you can watch. I mean, that's the reflection we use as monastics. The food that's given is fuel for the day and it's good enough to take us through. And then you can watch, like what we do with the food, is we look at the food and we contemplate. And then we watch our reaction, liking, disliking, or whatever. Usually, I mean, the food is so fabulous here that it's better than you have at home, so it's probably not a problem. But anyway, in terms of that, so in terms of taking that which is not given, and it's an interesting way to put that. In terms of, you know, there are deeper issues, of course, issues of copyright is a big issue, and customs, and, you know, there's all kinds of things that one could go into. A brahmacharya viramani, I undertake the precept to refrain from any kind of intentional sexual behavior. So this is celibacy. For lay life, it would be fidelity in relationships. But in monastic life, it is celibacy. So if sexual urges come into consciousness, fine. You observe, this is sexual urge, that's all. But you don't pursue it. So you can learn about sexuality as a celibate. You can't express it, but you can observe that energy in consciousness and be the witness to that, just as you can observe anger, whatever. I undertake the precept. So go back to that. If one thought that, like, if a celibate person, like a monastic, thought that it's bad to have sexual impulses, and you couldn't live the celibate life, you just become so totally repressed, you go nuts, right? But if you see there's a boundary, and then when sexual energy comes up, you say, oh, this is what sexuality feels like. It might be very, very strong. Ajahn Chah was one of the kind of major forces in his consciousness that he worked through. And some of his descriptions were pretty vivid. and he just, you know, just bore witness to it. Now that's not repression. That's not repression, but it's not indulgence, it's witnessing. Just as I can feel anger at someone and not follow it and not repress it. I can know anger feels this way. So celibacy is one of the kind of spiritual practices that we have in monasteries. And the fourth one, I take the precept to refrain from incorrect speech. So normally this would be lying or harsh speech or divisive gossip, those kinds of things. In terms of this retreat, it will be noble silence. Noble silence, whispering is not noble silence. This is one of the great fallacies of Buddhism. Basically what you want to do is be with yourself. You have a chance now just to be with yourself. And one of the beautiful things of noble silence is you don't have to be a personality. You don't have to describe what work you do and how many kids you have and where you know, you don't have to do all that, which is delightful. And also, you have, I think it's very important to honor the other people's silence. So not to draw them out into discussion, because sometimes, you know, people are polite, but then they, you know, they feel, gosh, you know, what was that about? So if you have any issue, housekeeping issues, Venerable is available to answer questions. If you have any issues in Dharma, I'm here. And if you just need to vent, then go out into the forest and yell at a panga. It's quite a skillful thing to do. Just let it out, because sometimes you have to vent. But you know, really guard the silence. So obviously there's going to be some talk that's going to come up around the kitchen or so on. Just minimize it, but don't get kind of, like, if you're going to talk, right? Just kind of, sometimes it's painful to see kind of people kind of whispering to each other, which is all right, I suppose. But basically, just try to do as little talking as possible. But be, you know, we can be adult about that. So what you'll find is then when you come from the kitchen, if you've been cutting vegetables and so on, if someone gets into a real kind of talking trip, just remind them. Say, I'm thanks, but I'm trying to practice noble silence. It's all right. It's part of it. And then if the kitchen has got busy, then you come back into the shrine and say, oh, this is what it feels like to be busy. You know, don't think that the whole experience is going to be like totally calm. It's all right. So if your mind gets busy, fine. That's what busyness feels like. Rather than resent that. Number five, I undertake the precept to refrain from intoxicating drink and drugs which lead to carelessness, so amphetamines and grass and things like that. Obviously, if you have medications you need, then you need to take them. So we're not altering consciousness with these things. I undertake the precept to refrain from eating at wrong times, so we'll have the times are set out, so it's quite clear. That makes life easy. Now, say, Vikala Bhoja, now that's not a, or the celibacy precept isn't a moral precept, it's a renunciant precept. The moral precept around sexuality would be fidelity and adultery. That's the issue there. It's not about sexuality. And so the sixth precept, to undertake the precept to refrain from eating at wrong times, has nothing to do with morality. It's about simplification. And it's about a community living together and kind of simplifying things. So, you know, it's not wrong to eat in the evening. That would be ridiculous. You know? So realize there are kind of levels that we use these protocols. Number seven, I undertake the precept to refrain from entertainment, beautification, and adornment. There's nothing wrong with wearing beautiful clothing or makeup or jewelry. There's nothing wrong with that. But in this context, it's to kind of simplify life. There's nothing wrong with entertainment and music and dancing and movies and all that. But in this context, it's a simplification. So both are simplifications, okay? So we don't have access to television and radio and da-da-da-da, all the things you can get distracted with. In terms of reading, I'd suggest if you are a compulsive reader, I would try fasting. If you're one of those people that takes a book to the toilet, I would try fasting on reading. It's a very interesting experiment. Right? Just like, again, reading is fine, but do try to limit your reading to Dharma rather than Pride and Prejudice or whatever. Better. But if you are a reader, you just think about it now. No internet, no television, no radio, no emails, no books and so on. And that can seem like a relief in the beginning, right? But after a few days, it's quite often you begin to crave that. You want some kind of stimulation, which is natural. Now if you can watch that desire for stimulation and not just buy into it, just, well, this is what restlessness feels like, and use that contemplation to be patient, that will take you to silence. But if you buy into the restlessness and just get busy, that'll take you to restlessness. And I know for myself, sometimes I've been so restless, you know, I'll clean my hut for an hour every day, you know, kind of obsessive cleaning just to do something. So you want to watch that need to do something, and just learn just to be on a bench and look at the pungas. It's just beautiful here. It's just so very, very beautiful. But the restless mind, you know, it needs stimulation. The eighth precept, I undertake the precept to refrain from lying on a high or luxurious sleeping place. This is a really odd one, right? And it comes from the time of the Buddha where luxury really was a kind of way that the mind became very lazy. And that's what it's pointing to. So I don't think we have very luxurious beds here, water beds. But basically, I guess the way I would reflect on that is don't just crash out. Although the schedule is so rigorous, I don't think. So sometimes we use sleep as a way of annihilation. We just annihilate consciousness, right? So get as much sleep as you need, but usually that's not really that applicable. So, that's what you're in for. Right? So when you take these precepts, that's the bargain, right? Or that's the deal or whatever. That's the kind of determination. So when you take precepts, what you're doing is you're making what we call developing adhitana barami. Adhitana is one of the virtuous qualities where you're making this really clear statement. For this period of time, I'm going to live by these precepts. And then they become reflections. They become reflections for you. Okay? So... if we go to page 59, so usually we start by, if those who want to, if you could bow three times, you could start with that. Bow three times, yeah. Sam Krangne. Bow three times, all right. Let me see. So what I'll do is I'll do it word by word for you. So put your hands in Anjali. So this is Anjali for those who want to. And I'll do it for you. Ahang. If you just follow after me. Ahang. Bante. Tisaranena. Saha. Atta. Silani. Yajami. Dutiyampi. Ahang bante. Tisaranena saha atta silani yajami tatiyampi ahangbante tisaranena saha atta silani yajami. So I'll chant the Namo Tassa three times, and after I've chanted it three times, in Pali, you repeat three times. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. And then flip over to 60, and line by line. Buddhang saranang gacchami. Dhammang saranang gacchami. Sanghang saranang gacchami. Dutiyampi buddhang saranang gacchami. Dutiyampi dhammang saranang gacchami. Dutiyampi sanghang saranang gacchami. Tatiyampi buddhang saranang gacchami. Tatiyampi dhammang saranang gacchami. Tatiyampi sanghang saranang gacchami. Tisaranagamanang nititang. over to 61. I'll do the Pali word by word, and then the English in one line. Panatipata Vedamani Sikapadam Samatiyami. I undertake the precept to refrain from destroying living creatures. Adinadana Vedamani Sikapadam Samatiyami. I undertake the precept to refrain from taking that which is not given. Brahmacharya Viramani Sikapadam Samatiyami. I undertake the precept to refrain from any kind of intentional sexual behavior. Musawada Viramani Sikapadam Samatiyami. I undertake the precept to refrain from incorrect speech. Suramereya Maja Pamadatana Viramani Sikapadam Samatiyami. I undertake the precept to refrain from intoxicating drink and drugs which lead to carelessness. Vikalabhojana Viramani Sikapadam Samatiyami. I undertake the precept to refrain from eating at wrong times. Nachagita Vadita Visukadasana Malaganda Vilepana Dharana Mandana Vipusanatana Viramani Sikapadam Samatiyami. I undertake the precept to refrain from entertainment, beautification, and adornment. Uchasayana Mahasayana Viramani Sikapadam Samatiyami. I undertake the precept to refrain from lying in a high or luxurious sleeping place. Over the page. Imani Atta Sikapadani Samatiyami. Imani Atta Sikapadani Samatiyami. Imani Atta Sikapadani Samatiyami. I undertake these eight precepts. I undertake these eight precepts. I undertake these eight precepts. Imani Atta Sikapadani Silena Sukatinyanti Silena Boga Sampata Silena Nipotinyanti Tasama Silam Sotaye. What's a high five in Buddhism? Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. So, what else? Have I forgotten anything? Oh, yes, okay. So, in terms of if anyone has any questions, there's a box here. If you put the questions in here, I might or might not answer them. I usually don't like to take questions from the floor because it gets very discursive, and I'd rather stay with the silence. I think the silences are valuable. If you have any personal questions or so on, or crises, I'm always available. I'll try to do group interviews later on. I don't have the energy to do individual interviews. But I thought maybe groups of five or whatever, we'll see how that goes, maybe Wednesday or Thursday. But if you have questions, I'm always available. Leave it over there? Okay. What else? Anyone, have I forgotten something that comes to mind? Schedule?
Yeah, the noon time now is
1:20. 1:20,
so we don't have to worry about
day. Oh, okay. Yeah. There's lots of time for eating. He's reassuring us. Okay. Yeah. Right. Just in terms of like this chores to be done and so on, we have, that's in the mornings, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it is it's an excellent opportunity to do a lot of pruning and weeding in the monastery. So it's nice if we can help, like, kind of, it's always good to think of the people who get most stressed in this kind of situation, and it's definitely the people in the kitchen. You know, they have to produce by a certain time, they have to feed us. And if you've been practicing sense deprivation, the meal is very important. So it's always like, how can we support the kitchen, and how can we make their life easy? So helping with the washing up and chopping and all that's very, very, very useful. And then just taking care of the monastery, use it as a kind of joyous practice. You know, give back, it's lovely. And if your knees are hurting, it's easier to do the weeding than the meditation anyway. So see it all as like, it's all part of mindfulness practice, but don't make mindfulness like this awful control. Sometimes mindfulness is people just trying to control themselves, you know, so they walk like robots or it's kind of... mindfulness is actually quite a joyous thing because it's an awakening as opposed to a controlling. You're awakening, you're opening the mind to the way things are. But sometimes you have to awaken to some pretty... you know, difficult material, and that's all right too. But see it like it's an opening of consciousness rather than a controlling. This is what works. Controlling doesn't work really. It holds things down for a while, and they all just go volcanic, aren't you? So opening. I think that's the spirit of it. I think that's it. Let's. I think the morning bell is at 5:30. So. If we could all be in here at 6. So generally, the etiquette of a monastery is to be early rather than to come a bit late, obviously. And so there's a kind of sense of decorum, obviously. And so the senior person, myself, comes in last. So like if I come in a bit late, don't take that as a cue that you can come in late tomorrow. Because then it'll just get chaotic, right? So just, you know, this makes it very beautiful and easy. And then when you come in, just start meditating, right? Just come, bow. If you like the bow, you don't have to bow. You use the form. And then we'll proceed from there. So perhaps we could finish with the sharing of merit, if you want to.